Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, November 16th. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, webmails, e-pages, so that you can take action for the environment. Let's start with Hudson Valley Earth First. They're going to be having an action camp in New York, December 1st through 4th. We will be offering workshops, climb training, and most importantly, campaign updates. The Hudson Valley faces many fossil fuel infrastructure projects, all gearing up for construction as we speak. Learn about the Valley Lateral Pipeline, Legoland Theme Park Project, the Competitive Power Ventures Power Plant, and more. Come find out how to plug into the local resistance. We need all hands on deck. The exact location will be in the Hudson Valley, but they're not announcing it at the moment. So please email them at hudsonvalleyearthfirst@riseup.net. That's hudsonvalleyearthfirst@riseup.net. And let them know you're coming and if you have any questions. You can also visit their webpage at hudsonvalleyearthfirst.org. And they say, see you soon. And in Indiana, night owls have disrupted the state forest timber sale in this story submitted anonymously to the Earth First Newswire. On the morning of Thursday, November 9th, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources Division of Forestry sold the timber rights to 299 acres of the Yellowwood State Forest backcountry areas that are some of the oldest and most diverse in the state. Nearly 2,000 trees were sold to Hamilton Logging, who have a long history of shady business practices and timber theft. Despite over 200 people showing up to protest the sale, months of organizing against the planned logging and a recent protest encampment being established on private property adjacent to the public land to be logged, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources insisted on selling another piece of some of the most wild and beautiful land in the state for a mere $108,000. So during the weekend following the sale, we painted hundreds of additional trees to match those the DNR had marked for removable in two of three tracks on the chopping block. We did this to obscure the trees Hamilton Logging bought and to force the DNR Division of Forestry to redo the work of making these tracks and delaying when logging can start. We understand there is a risk that these additional trees could be cut down, but only if the DNR Division of Forestry and Hamilton Logging show unprecedented intentional negligence by letting a group of pranksters mark the trees for them. Logging all currently marked trees would be a violation of the contract between the two parties, which only includes the trees the DNR chose to mark, not the hundreds more we marked with identical paint and markings. We hope that by painting these additional trees, we can stop them from taking action on any of them, or at least slow them down. To other defenders of Yellowwood, there may be many more trees left untouched. All it takes is red or blue marking paint and some careful navigation. We wish you luck and look forward to all the other creative and inspiring ways you'll think of to protect the land. Signed, Night Owl Paint and Exteriors. And in the United Kingdom, a hunt saboteur has been punched in the face by a hunt saboteur. On Thursday, November 9th, members of the West Midlands hunt saboteurs were monitoring the Warwickshire hunt, who were hunting in Burdenbury, Warwickshire. Whilst they were filming the hounds, two male hunt supporters approached the saboteurs and became increasingly aggressive. One of them hit one of the cameras before punching a female saboteur in the face. When her back is turned on him, he starts shoving her and then pushes her to the ground. When she challenges him about hitting her, he can be heard saying, "You hit me if you want, I don't give a blank, blank, blank." Back on the road, one hunt saboteur apologizes and says that never should have happened and then agrees that despite their differences, the saboteurs have never been violent towards them. The saboteurs then challenge the Warwickshire hunt senior master, Charmaine Green, and ask her if she thinks it is acceptable to hit women. A female passenger in the back says, "You're not a woman, you're a monster," and that's nothing, referring to the blood coming from the saboteur's eye. A spokesperson for the West Midlands hunt saboteurs said, "We are concerned that the hunt were hunting a fox and that the hounds were heading toward a busy main road. Suddenly, two Hunt supporters approach us and start shouting aggressively before attacking us. It shows what type of people hunt foxes and that they think they are acceptable for men to attack women, punch them, and then shove them over from behind. He even later admits on camera to what he had done. Lee Moon, spokesperson for the Hunt Saboteurs Association, stated, "Fox hunting by its very nature is a violent activity and only a short leap from using violence towards animals to using violence against people. Just like they try to justify their violence towards foxes by vilifying them as pests, they try to justify their violence towards hunt saboteurs by calling them monsters. This was a completely unprovoked attack by a very violent hunt. Fox hunting is a breeding ground for normalizing violence with some of the very questionable attitudes toward women. We ask the question, who are the real monsters here?" After being punched in the face, the female saboteur received injuries to her eye and had to attend A&E at the Warwick Hospital. And Polish police have broken up a protest against the Białowieża forest logging. In this story from DW is found on the Earth First Newswire. A police spokeswoman said on Thursday the police had detained 22 people for disturbing the peace at the headquarters of Poland's Forestry Management Agency, with the police at times using force to remove up to 50 protesters. "We're calling for the withdrawal of heavy machinery from the Białowieża forest. We demand an end to the logging," said Adam Brohan, one of the activists who chained himself to a security gate inside the agency building. "All of our activity, peaceful marches, petitions, blockades at the scene have had no effect. Forest management continues to fell trees despite the decision of the European judiciary. And so we adopted this ultimate form of protest," he told the French news agency AFP. "Many believe the move to open up logging in the Białowieża forest is a show of strength by the nationalistic law and justice government, intent on showing the EU, which has accused the government of undermining democracy in the last 2 years, that it has the power to do what it wishes on its own land." Forestry Management spokeswoman Anna Malinowska described the protest organized by the Odos Diabłuskie Camp for the Forest Environmental Coalition as illegal. The activists could face penalties ranging from fines up to a year behind bars. Scientists, ecologists, and the EU have protested the action. Activists have said Warsaw is defying a European Court of Justice injunction to suspend logging in the forest. The government has been accused by the European Commission of logging trees that are 100 years old and older, an act which is illegal under European Union law. Forest patrols by Greenpeace Poland in August found evidence of loggers violating the EU's court decision in 16 of 30 forest areas. Białowieża includes one of the largest surviving parts of a primeval forest that covered most of the European plains about 10,000 years ago. The woodland, which straddles Poland's border with Belarus, is home to unique plant and animal life, including 800 European bison, the continent's largest mammal. The government began logging in May last year, saying it was clearing dead trees to contain damage caused by a spruce bark beetle infestation. It also justified its move, saying it was combating the risk of forest fires. This saw the limit raised from 63,000 cubic meters of wood to 188,000 cubic meters, with about 80,000 cubic meters estimated to have been cleared since the limit was increased. In September, the European Commission asked the European Court of Justice to fine Poland for violating a ban on logging in the forest. In recent weeks, the Polish government has accused the Commission of spreading lies and manipulating the facts. The Polish Environment Ministry said it was not in violation of an EU order, as it is only felling trees for public safety reasons. Environment Minister Jan Suszko told a parliamentary hearing in September that logging was only to save the forest from a major beetle outbreak and that it respected EU laws. He said logging was taking place only in regular parts of the forest, not in the protected national park. And from Bite Back, we read that the Animal Liberation Front has toppled two towers and two traps used for hunting in Italy. It was signed as ALF and a painted message left behind, "Hunters are merda." And Trump has lifted a ban on the import of elephant trophies from two African nations. The Trump administration will reverse an Obama-era ban on the importation of elephant trophies from Zimbabwe and Zambia after determining that sport hunting in those countries will help conserve the species, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service confirmed on Wednesday. The decision was made public not by the federal agency, but via a celebratory news release early Tuesday from Safari Club International, a trophy hunting advocacy group that, along with the National Rifle Association, sued to block the 2014 ban. Greg Sheehan, principal deputy director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, broke the news to the hunting organization during the African Wildlife Consultative Forum in Tanzania, an agency spokesperson told Huffington Post. The forum, which runs through Friday, is being hosted by the Safari Club International Foundation and the United Republic of Tanzania. African elephants have been listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act since 1978. A provision of the law, however, allows for sport-hunted trophies to be imported if the government determines that hunting will help safeguard the population. A Fish and Wildlife Service spokesperson provided the Huffington Post with a pair of nearly identical statements regarding the agency's findings for elephants in Zimbabwe and Zambia. Legal, well-regulated sport hunting as part of a sound management program can benefit the conservation of certain species by providing incentives to local communities to conserve the species and by putting much-needed revenue back into conservation, the spokesperson wrote. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has determined that the hunting and management programs for African elephants in Zimbabwe and Zambia will result in the survival of the species in the wild. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife is seeking information related to the Cascades frog. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife is seeking information relevant to a proposal to list the Cascades frog as an endangered or threatened species. The Cascades frog, also known as Rana cascadei, inhabits a variety of habitats such as large lakes, ponds, wet meadows, and streams at mid to high elevations, ranging from the Klamath Trinity region along the Cascades Range axis in the vicinity of Mount Shasta, southwards to the headwater tributaries of the Feather River. In March of 2017, the Center for Biological Diversity submitted a petition to the California Fish and Game Commission to formally list the Cascades frog as endangered or threatened under the California Endangered Species Act. The listing petition and CDFW's petition evaluation described a variety of threats to the survival of Cascades frogs in California. These include direct and indirect impacts associated with airborne contaminants, climate change, disease, fire suppression, habitat loss and alteration, introduced fish, livestock grazing, recreational activities, small population sizes, and cannabis cultivation. CDFW recommended and the commission voted in advance the species to candidacy on October 11th. The commission published its findings on October 27th. Which triggered a 12-month period during which CDFW will conduct a status review to inform the Commission's decision on whether to list the species. As part of the status review process, California Department of Fish and Wildlife is soliciting information from the public regarding the Cascade frog's ecology, genetics, life history, distribution, abundance, habitat, and the degree and immediacy of threats to reproduce or survive, adequacy of existing management, and recommendations for the management of the species. Comments, data, and other information can be submitted in writing to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, attention Laura Patterson, 1812 9th Street in Sacramento, California. The zip is 95811. That address again for comments on the Cascades frog is California Department of Fish and Wildlife, attention Laura Patterson, 1812 9th Street in Sacramento, California. 95811. You can also submit comments by email to wildlifemgt@wildlife.ca.gov. That's wildlifemgt@wildlife.ca.gov. And please include Cascades frogs in the subject headline. Comments received by December 22nd of 2017 will be evaluated prior to submittal of the CDFW report to the Commission. Receipt of the report will be placed on the agenda for the next available meeting of the Commission after delivery, and the report will be made available to the public at that time. Following the receipt of the CDFW report, the commission allows a 30-day public comment period prior to taking any action on CDFW's recommendations. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Center for Biological Diversity's paperwork and petition are available at the CDFW website. That's www.fgc.ca.gov. That's www.fgc.ca.gov. And in Canada, protesters have been ordered off the Midsummer Island Fish Farm in this story from Warrior Publications as found in the Earth First Newswire. First Nations protesters have been ordered to vacate their camp on a fish farm near Midsummer Island for 30 days while they prepare for a court date on Marine Harvest application for an injunction that would see them permanently removed from the site. Protesters of First Nations have been occupying a shelter attached to the fish farm southeast of Port McNeill since early September, demanding that Marine Harvest shut down operations in their traditional territories. At the direction of the Supreme Court of British Columbia, the protesters now have 3 days to remove their structures from the farm. This adjournment gives our hereditary and elected leadership more time to get legal action and negotiations organized to remove these farms from our waters legally and permanently, said Muskamawag protester Molina Dawson. First Nations have asked the British Columbia government not to renew leases on farm sites in the Broughton Archipelago when they expired in next June. "We would have preferred to stay on Midsummer," she said. "Now our concern is that Marine Harvest will use this time to restock the farms with salmon." Marine Harvest has harvested salmon from the farm in recent weeks, but has delayed restocking because of safety concerns about the protesters. "We will review the biological schedule of our fish as we raise a living, growing animal," said Marine Harvest Canada's managing director, Vincent Ernst. "Until meaningful discussions are taking place to find long-term solutions, we will concentrate on continuing to take care of our fish and our employees." Ernst urged senior levels of the British Columbian government to find a solution to First Nations concerns about their rights and title to the land. "This important government-to-government discussion needs to occur so our business and other businesses in the province can be given clarity about this process," he said. Agriculture Minister Lana Puffham, the government's lead minister on the fish farm file, has indicated a willingness to hear First Nations concerns. "We are looking forward to making a consultation process government to government, and we are looking for a starting point," Popham told Post Media News after she and Premier John Horgan, visited First Nations leaders near Alert Bay last month. "At that meeting, we promised to continue negotiations while we worked forward," she said. And in this story from the Earth First Newswire, "I released 2,000 minks from a fur farm. Now I'm a convicted terrorist," in this story written by Kevin Johnson as found in The Guardian on the Earth First Newswire. "People usually laugh when I tell them I am a convicted terrorist. I try not to open with that. It seems a little bit forward. First, I explain how my friend Tyler and I entered a fur farm at the dead of night. I describe the unspeakable suffering we found there. I tell people how Tyler and I opened every single cage and released 2,000 mink to save their lives. And once they have the context, I segue into the terrorism thing. Now that I have been out of prison for more than a year, I can be a bit more lighthearted about it, but the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals doesn't see the humor. Last Wednesday, the court upheld the constitutionality of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, the federal statute that put me away for 3 years and that my lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights have been trying to challenge for nearly a decade. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a piece of designer legislation written and paid for by the agriculture and pharmaceutical industries. It federalizes nonviolent property crime and punishes it as terrorism, but only when the perpetrators are motivated by the belief that animals deserve to live free from violence. The court explicitly stated that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act did not apply to four Fresno, California teenagers who sneaked into a Foster Farms facility and bludgeoned 900 chickens to death with a golf club because they killed the chicken for no reason. "Put succinctly, I am a terrorist not because of what I did, but because the government dislikes why I did it. I remember organizing my first protest outside of a circus in 2005. I was 19 years old. My friend and I argued with the police about whether our group could stand in a courtyard by the Staples Center and whether we could use megaphones. We asserted our rights and we were successful. That same year, the FBI declared animal rights activists to be the nation's number one domestic terrorism threat. A year later, Congress passed the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Suddenly, I found myself being followed as I drove to work. My parents and siblings were harassed. My home was raided by the Joint Terrorism Task Force 3 times. We no longer argued with the police about where we could chant and hold our signs. The police brandished assault rifles, and we did as they said. Then, when we were done, they openly followed us back to our cars to photograph our license plates. While the rest of the nation took no notice, simply organizing a protest became a frightening prospect if you were an animal rights activist. In this atmosphere, more and more of my friends stopped speaking out for animals. Countless times I heard people say they were scared of being placed on a list. More than once, someone told me they had canceled their subscription to animal-related magazines. The Animal Terrorism Act achieved its intended outcome when the distinguishing feature of a terrorist is simply an ethical concern for animals. Such concerns become marginalized and voicing them becomes dangerous. What remains is silence. Now I watch as the rhetoric honed and the precedents established against animal rights activists are expanded to cover an increasingly broad swath of dissent. In Donald Trump's America, states across the country are introducing legislation designed to bully and deter protesters. Some of these proposed laws include 5 years of prison for protesters who even block traffic. Lawmakers in Arizona seek to charge protest groups as organized criminals and seize their assets. In Oregon, a statute would automatically expel students who violate protest laws. Missouri wants to criminalize the use of costumes during protests. And following the horrors of Charlottesville, lawmakers in half a dozen states have introduced legislation to indemnify drivers who run over protesters as if the drivers were the ones in need of protection. This is not how a free society operates. Our rights are meaningless if the government intimidates us out of using them. But as Wendy's decision makes clear, the judiciary will not protect us from such abuse. The court has legitimized the government's use of the word terrorism to describe nearly any activity of which government disapproves and emboldened lawmakers around the country who are beginning to do just that. It is evident that our leaders consider our speech and assemblies as a threat to their unencumbered exercise of power. Now, more than ever, we must show them that they are right. And Sea Shepherd's campaign to save the vaquita porpoise has launched in Mexico with 2 vessels, the motor vessel Farley Moad and MV John Paul de Joria, kick off Operation Milagro 4 in the Gulf of California in collaboration with the Mexican government. Continuing its relentless commitment to stop the imminent extinction of the endangered vaquita porpoise, Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is returning to Mexico's Gulf of California for Operation Milagro 4. Milagro 4 is a vaquita defense campaign. We'll have Sea Shepherd's vessels Farley Moat back on active duty for the 3rd consecutive year in the Gulf of California, the only waters on Earth that are home to this shy and elusive mammal. Joining the Farley for the first time on a Milagro campaign will be the motor vessel John Paul de Joria. The vessel is arriving from the Caribbean, where it was engaged in Operation Good Pirates of the Caribbean, a relief mission that brought aid to islands affected by Hurricanes Maria and Irma. With Milagro 4, Sea Shepherd will once again work with the Mexican government to address the urgent need to protect the elusive vaquita porpoise before it is too late. Both vessels will protect the waters of the Vaquita Marine Reserve, remove nets, patrol for poachers, document issues facing this endangered cetacean, and continue to collect data to share with the scientific community. The campaign will run through May of 2018. And there's a real problem in Montana for deer hunters as chronic wasting disease has arrived in the state. For deer hunters, this is the best week of the year, the week that the rut strips bucks of their inhibitions and gives us a fighting chance to beat their senses. But for Montana deer hunters, it's the worst week of the year. This will be remembered as the week that chronic wasting disease arrived in the state. For me personally, this dread week has been nearly 20 years in the making. Here's what we know. A mule deer buck killed by a hunter in the south central part of the state, not far from the Wyoming border, has tested positive for CWD, the news announced recently. The disease has been prevalent in Wyoming for nearly 40 years and has been creeping northward, and so in some ways, it's unsurprising that chronic wasting disease would show up in Montana. The Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department has been watching the borders, testing as many deer as possible in those peripheral areas, and the fact that the CWD-positive buck was found is proof of the vigilance was both warranted and effective. But that's slim consolation for those of us who have been watching CWD spread across the country. 23 states now have CWD-positive herds, and wildlife managers and hunters have tried to learn how to live with the malady, which is always fatal to the animals it infects. The distressing thing about CWD is that its shadow extends beyond its ungulate victims. It affects land valuation, our enjoyment of the hunt, and while there has been no evidence that an animal that tests positive for CWD can pass the disease on to humans, it cultures a fret that grows in the back of every hunter's mind. Is this meat healthy for my family to eat? And a team has found the first wild alligator snapping turtle in Illinois since 1984. Researchers report the first sighting in 30 years of a wild alligator snapping turtle. The discovery may be a sign of hope for this state endangered species, or the animal could be the last of its kind to have survived in Illinois without human intervention. The team reports that the find in the Southeastern Naturalist Journal. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this show, tune in tomorrow to Free Radio at 3 p.m. on Fridays. Or you can listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. Or WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. Also broadcasting the Earth First Update is KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and the Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California. Please check their schedules for the day and time. You can always tune in to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First updates. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and to broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening. Please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.